Hi, friends. Welcome to Season 5 of The Activity Continues, a paranormal podcast. I'm Amy, the producer and host of this show, along with Megan and the other Amy. We are three soul friends who love to talk about the Dead Files TV show, along with other spooky and spooky adjacent things. We are just starting our third year, and it's going to be the best one yet.
Hi, everyone. I'm Megan, our resident scaredy cat. I love this stuff, but it absolutely terrifies me.
It doesn't terrify me.
Me neither.
Most of the time. Hey, everyone. I'm the other Amy, sometimes referred to as Amy, ABP, or AP. And I'm the voice of reason in the chaos, trying to keep these two spooky, goofy, lovely ladies in line. We're creating a community of like-minded friends who love to discuss all things paranormal. We're always looking for more cool and interesting people to talk to. So if you're interested, please reach out to theactivitycontinues@gmail.com. or fill out the guest intake form on our website, theactivitycontinues.com. We'd love to hear from you. Come join us where
the activity continues.
Do not attempt to adjust the settings on your device. The sounds you hear are not hallucinations. You have crossed into the domain of a traveler that has a taste for telling tales about the macabre, the strange, the unusual, and the morbid. Don't be shy. Step inside and take a seat by the fire and enjoy your visit into the world that is the Nightcap Nebula. Greetings, my friends, and welcome back to the Nightcap Nebula podcast, where nothing is taboo or wicked, and the topics are always eerie and intriguing. Every action has an equal or opposite reaction, but there are times where the possibilities of said action can lead to unintended and really whacked out consequences, where the end result is either serious deformity, extreme bodily harm, and death. That isn't to say the route that led these people down such a windy, tumultuously harrowing path isn't somewhat interesting, but really makes you think about your mortality and take a glimpse into the madness of the human condition. More importantly, what could go horribly wrong at a moment's notice? Why wait any longer? Let's just jump into it with both feet. Pull up your safety belts, get cozy in your hypoallergenic foam chair, and prepare for the top 10 astonishingly aghast deaths and demises. Ancient times call for ancient ways, and the most prolific of all figures were usually royalty or some degree of aristocracy or prestige. Egyptian lore has some of the most bizarre and mythical stories that revolve around their pharaohs, but none more than with Menes. Born around 3200 BC, Menes was credited with uniting the upper and lower parts of Egypt and being the founder of the first dynasty. His real identity is sketchy, but most scholars narrowed it down to his name either being Nakata III, ruler of Narmer, or Pharaoh Horhaha. The recognized name of Menes was a play on the Greek god Min. The Egyptian version is from the 19th century and is translated as he who endures, which is fitting for a ruler. What is odd is his almost complete lack of records, suggesting his real name, which could mean his title, was more important and it just stuck. He accomplished a lot for his culture, including inventing writing, according to Pliny. Not all of it was good, however, as some of his peers blame Menes for providing the idea of luxury to his people and, more grisly, the practice of sacrifices, two activities that don't exactly mesh well, depending on who you ask, of course. Aside from his few but impactful exploits, this is pretty much all that is known. Interestingly, before his death, he supposedly had a near-death experience, according to Diorosis Siculus, who recorded a story of Menes. Priests who worshipped the crocodile god Sobek said he was attacked by his own dogs while out hunting and fled across Lake Moeris on the back of a crocodile and, in thanks, founded the city of Crocodopolis, where said priests reside. This, of course, was loosely translated, and one scholar, Gaston Mesberb, claims this was a bad interpretation and patently devoid of historical value, but mildly amusing nonetheless. What isn't so amusing, although some might think it today, is his actual death. Menes did not have many enemies. In fact, his enemies were so few, he rarely traveled with guards. However, the real dangers are right in his own backyard, in the form of animals, and letting your guard down near places like the Nile River can mean the difference between survival and an early grave. Unfortunately, Menes got the latter. Early one morning, while on a hunting trip, he got careless and waded into waist-deep water, not realizing that he was being watched by a prey most people underestimate, the fearsome hippopotamus. Before he could react, one seized him in his mighty jaws and carried him off into the bushes to be mutilated and ultimately killed, marking the end of his 60-year reign. A grand ceremony was held with incense. His organs were removed and put into canopic jars beside his sarcophagus. Time was not kind to his burial, as it was never recovered, but his legacy was at least partially recovered and his fate not lost to the sands of time. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, or in this case, a hippo in the hand is worth run for your life to another far away bush. Greek and Roman mythology will be brought up a few times in this list due to the seemingly never-ending amount of mythos surrounding each culture, and rest assured, there is also no shortage of highly strange circumstances surrounding the individuals who now sing for the choir invisible. Let's take a look at Draco of Athens regarding his ghostly membership. Draco was born in 625 BC and was the first recorded legislator in Athens. Before his revision, oral law and blood feuds were the way of things by which you either respected what was said based on a societal hierarchy, usually uttered by the upper class, that was not usually challenged, or you retaliated with violence, malice, or trickery due to the offense which got on the nerves of the citizens of ancient Greece. Draco established a democratic system called the Draconian Constitution, in which anyone could read the code at a centralized location instead of interpretation by word of mouth. This set the beginnings of democracy in which most of the civilized world adheres to today. Most of his laws under the Constitution were repealed by a diplomat named Solon, with the exception of the homicide law, which stipulates that the family of a victim can decide whether to prosecute the killer or show mercy. While that is impressive, it is worth knowing that Draco may be a base name for a body of aristocrats, not a single person, which would explain a lack of biographical information. But even the great philosopher Aristotle noted Draco as being a vital component to helping push forward what was an already emerging democratic system, so it may just be that recording on his past was terrible. While I could go into greater detail of the finer points of the beginnings of Greek law, his death is incredibly perplexing, flattering, and tragic at the same time. Draco was exiled to the island of Aegina, where he spent the remainder of his days not really doing much except spending time at the theater, keeping a low profile, and apparently schmoozing the locals with his charm. The story goes that one day he was lounging around and, in a wave of violent admiration, was covered in hats, cloaks, and shirts by the citizens of the island, and the weight of them was all so great that he couldn't breathe and he suffocated. It is unclear if this is a true account of what happened, or if he inhaled poison or had a heart attack, but the lore still stands, and rightfully so, since it's a very memorably twisted end to a very memorable, accomplished life. A person's finery is a reflection of their character and status, but being killed by those garments is a lethal version of the things you own end up owning you. The tortured artist archetype has plagued the left brain since the first hominid was capable of smashing berries into crude paste to paint with. Those lucky enough to make a living creating beauty are seen as elitist, and those that die poor get rich through their descendants. There is a middle category, and a very funny one, in the case of Greek painter Zeuxis. Born in 464 BC in Heraclea, Lucania, Zeuxis was an accomplished artist with much of his works depicting highly realistic images, which, at the time, was the mark of a master and is still revered, but due to what types of media were available at the time, it is quite impressive. The saddest part to his life is that not a single one of his works survived, leaving only anecdotes and mentions of his craft being uttered by the likes of Pliny the Elder, Aristotle, Xenophon, and Mark Twain. One of the most famous stories about Zeuxis centers on an artistic competition with the artist Parrhasius to prove which artist could create a greater illusion of nature. It is said that Zeuxis created grapes that were so realistic that birds saw the image and attempted to eat them. Shortly after, he went to view Parrhasius' painting and asked that the curtain be lifted so he could look at the image, only to discover that the curtain was itself the painting. Zeuxis had admitted defeat since he did trick birds, but he himself was tricked, and being one of the best artists of his century, it hit harder. A similar story said that Zeuxis once drew a boy holding grapes, and when birds once again tried to peck them, he was extremely displeased, stating that he must have painted the boy with less skill, since the birds would have feared to approach otherwise. Never satisfied with his portraits, it seemed, he always excelled it in whatever he made, using light and shadow to create emphasis on the subject matter rather than flat brushstrokes. The trade-off is his technique would prove to provide a hilarious end. On one particular evening, Zeuxis was feeling daring, and instead of painting beautiful women, or those with features that may make Aphrodite cry, he chose a homely-looking old woman, called a challenge unto himself to see if he could extract beauty from the unsightly. As he was painting, he began to notice how extraordinarily funny his subject looked. As he finished up, the picture came more into view as to why she was so funny-looking. Capturing on canvas made it even more hilarious to him. He had achieved perfection in the most mirthful vision he could muster, and then the emotion burst forward like a tsunami and started belly laughing like it was the last one he'd ever have, and, tragically, it was. He began choking, fell into the painting, almost hitting the woman, and died. It is hard to tell if the story is true or not, as grammarians like to embellish on details, but it may be true due to others who have died from the same thing. The story still remains one for the history books. There is no greater fun in games than being alive. Just be careful not to let the idea of it bring you to such hilarity that you end up on the other side. King Tut, the boy king, was obviously a tragedy in Egyptian mythology, but there are other regal figures that met an even weirder end, and somewhat embarrassing to say the least, and around the same age as well. Let's examine Louis III. Born in St. Denis, France, 863 AD, his father was king of Aquitaine, and his grandfather was the ruler of West Francia. His legitimacy was questioned since his parents married in secret, and it was proposed that his brothers share power after his father died in 877. He and his brothers had many losses against their adversaries, including the Vikings, but they saw a few key victories, such as at the Battle of Sacol un Vumu, in which a poem was written about it called Lugwidslid. Now, most say he had never achieved much, but considering he was only around 16 or 17 years old suggests differently, as he was celebrated and loved by his people. His death was unfortunately what he was remembered for. Like any teenager, Louis loved to go after young girls, and he had his eye on one in particular while riding. She enjoyed the chase, and he caught her retreating to her father's house when he hit his head on the lintel of a low door, suffering massive head trauma, fracturing his skull, and later died. Because Louis III had no children, his brother became the sole king of West Francia, and the young king was buried in the royal mausoleum of the Basilica of St. Denis. Tragic, yes, but Charles VIII died under similar circumstances, except it was in his own bathroom after he slipped on his own urine. Definitely much more embarrassing, if you ask me. Nevertheless, Louis left his mark in some ways, and in others, history left a mark on him. Always mind your surroundings, especially if you're gallivanting around the countryside in search of some tale. Fate may come a-knocking in more ways than you like. I love a good cooking competition, and it is always interesting to see what these amateur and professional chefs whip up with limited ingredients. There is a time, however, when the cuisine in question can mean utter dismay or elated decadence. What do you think is the case with François Vatal? Born in either Switzerland or Paris in 1625, depending on who you ask, Francois is widely but incorrectly credited with creating Chantilly cream, which is a sweet vanilla-flavored whipped cream. Vatel served Louis XIV Superintendent Nicolas Fouquet in the inauguration of the Château d'Ivoire-le-Vicomte that took place on the 17th of August 1661. He took pride in serving and was said to be extremely proper and strict in his duties, which is why his only real claim to fame, so to speak, is a bit pathetic given how much he stood on ceremony. It all occurred one day at a grand gala where Vatel was responsible for extravagant banquet for 2,000 people hosted in honor of Louis XIV by the Grand Condé in April 1671 at the Château de Chantilly. According to a letter by Madame de Sévigné, Vatel was so distraught about the lateness of the seafood delivery and about other mishaps that he committed suicide by running himself through with a sword, and his body was discovered when someone came to tell him of the arrival of the fish. This incident was thought to be the origin of the idiom "died for want of lobster sauce," a phrase meaning to die or be devastated due to a minor disappointment or mishap. I did say that he was very strict about his duties, but this kind of action, yeesh. His life became somewhat of a mockery across the French culinary world, to where they referred to any sauce mishap as a valet, and there was even a historical film about him called Valet. But in the film, it wasn't the fish that he offed himself over. It was because he was being pushed around by the aristocracy. The funny thing is, such little is known about this man that no one is really sure why he took his own life. But may he rest in peace. Too many cooks spoil the broth, but too much stress can destroy the kitchen. Stick to simple recipes, and please, be nice to your waiter. Brightness can pierce the darkest night, and lighthouses are beacons of hope for those at sea. It is an important job that goes largely unnoticed, unless you're a mariner, fisherman, or avid boater. In the old days, it was all sailors could rely on, so let us delve into the Henry Hall story. Born in 1661 in Eastone House, Plymouth, England, Henry is the oldest known member of the Hall family of lighthouse keepers that kept lights around the English and Welsh coasts from at least the mid-18th century until 1913. The Hall family intermarried with two lighthouse keeping families, the Knotts and the Darling family. One of the better known members of Darling family was Grace Darling, who participated in the rescue of survivors from the shipwrecked Forfarshire. Henry is mostly remembered for his actions following a fire at the Eddystone Lighthouse on December 2nd, 1755, when the wooden Rudyard's Tower of 1706 burned down. At around 2 a.m., he was on duty alone when he discovered that a spark from the lamp had set the roof alight. He attempted to put the fire out, throwing buckets of water 4 yards higher than his head, and Henry was soon joined by the other two lighthouse keepers who also tried to extinguish the fire. He looked up to check his progress, and to his horror, found himself showered with falling molten lead from the lighthouse roof. It fell upon his body, burning his head, face, neck, and shoulders, and more lethally, into his mouth, which was unfortunately open, and went down his throat. He later recalled that he felt the hot lead and screamed, "My God, I'm on fire inside." Nevertheless, he continued to help his fellow lighthouse keepers, but the three weren't able to put the fire out. The men were forced to retreat down the tower and eventually made their way to a cave to avoid the falling red-hot debris. The fire continued to burn for 4 more days and the men were pulled to safety by passing sailors. Henry and the others were treated for injuries, but the attending physician, Dr. Spry, claimed that Henry was exhibiting no other symptoms aside from internal pain, but he was flabbergasted that anyone could survive such an ordeal. Days after the fire, Henry was able to eat, drink, and take medicine, but complained of minor stomach irritation as one would. However, on the 6th day, Dr. Spry noticed his health starting to decline. Sadly, the next day, Henry died at his home at the ripe old age of 94 from cold sweats and spasms of the tendons. An autopsy was conducted, and as you would guess, the molten lead caused massive internal damage, and it took just a bit longer to kill its victim than the doctor figured. In a horrible footnote to this, since his colleagues did not outright believe Dr. Spry's report, he conducted tests on cats and dogs to prove that it is possible to live after having molten lead ingested, leading to many animals being tortured to prove a point to the medical community. As for Henry, there is a small plaque dedicated to him in Plymouth City Center, set into the pavement between Plymouth Pavilion's Salumi Bar and Eatery, and the Duke of Cornwall Hotel at Mill Bay Road. The piece of lead found in his stomach is now kept in the National Museum of Scotland, if you care about such curiosities. 'Tis better to burn out than fade away, that's for sure. But sometimes at a certain age during a certain time, dying in this fashion is the Grim Reaper chuckling to himself and making you a folk legend. Youth has its pitfalls and advantages. Being daring and carefree are definitely pluses. The minuses are, of course, being careless, hedonistic, and a bit reckless, to where it can land you in a world of hurt, as is the case with Archduchess Mathilde. Born on the 25th of 1849 in Vienna in the Austrian Empire, her full name is quite the mouthful, Archduchess Mathilde Marie Egeldund Alexandra of Austria. Her father was a prominent field marshal in the Austrian-Hungarian army, and her mother was a princess of Bavaria. From great-grandparents in the Holy Roman Empire and other royalty, she comes from a long line of influential figureheads, and had siblings that married into royalty. Unfortunately, her life was short-lived and ultimately was surrounded by stuffy individuals with no humor and a lack of excitement, which is probably why her demise is so sad. Being a bit of a secret rebel, back then drinking and smoking was seen as uncouth and beneath someone of her stature, but some did it anyway to spite their parents just like today's youth, but there was more at stake in those days. Mathilde had regular outings with her family, and on this particular evening, she had put on a gauze dress to go to the theater, then lit a cigarette to smoke. Soon after, she had heard the approach of her father, who had strictly forbidden smoking. She quickly hid the cigarette behind her, but, in doing so, set the very flammable material of her dress on fire. She suffered second and third degree burns on her whole body, with parts of her dress burning into her skin, and she died of her injuries shortly after the accident. Her whole family had witnessed her horrific death. As was family tradition, her heart was buried in the Loreto Chapel of the Augustinian Church of Vienna, and her body entombed in the Capuchin Church, which is also in Vienna. Most of her family rests there as well, with their remains being relocated to a new crypt in 1895. Cancer from smoking, breathing problems from smoking, and accidental self-immolation, apparently. Just a suggestion, but maybe chew some Nicorette gum to avoid a similar fate, or just to smell nicer. I don't relish anyone's death. Well, no one that really deserved it anyhow. Anyone that makes someone's life marginally horrible or kills someone else deserves to get the axe, and I take no degree of joy in that. However, some deaths just make me cock my head to the side and say, what in the fresh hell happened here, without getting any real answers, and that frustrates me. Since that is the case with a man named William, this will be unceremoniously short, but it's worth it. Sir William Payne Galway, 2nd Baronet, was born in 1807 to his father of the same name, who was the 1st Baronet, and also a general of the British Army and governor of the Leeward Islands. His mother, Harriet Quinn, was the daughter of the 1st Earl of Dunraven. Following in his father's footsteps, William became a major in the 7th Fusiliers and succeeded him in baronetcy in 1831, and was also a Justice of the Peace, Deputy Lieutenant for the North Riding of Yorkshire, and elected Member of Parliament for Thirsk in 1851, and finally stepping down in 1880. Suffice it to say, he was a very accomplished man, even surpassing his father in many ways, which makes what happened to him not only unreal, but downright hysterical. On December 19, 1881, William was out in the parish of Bagby attempting to wrangle up wild game in a turnip field. Details are incredibly sparse since there weren't any witnesses around, but it was said William fired his rifle, it pushed him back, and he landed right square on top of a giant turnip stalk that impaled him, piercing his internal organs, and killed him. Medical examiners that attempted to help him claimed they could do little to save him as his health was already failing, but it isn't said why. I mean, what? A prominent and apparently respected man for his time dies in this fashion, and there isn't any follow-up as to how this occurred. History doesn't say much about him, despite his obituary saying that he erected low-rent cottages and championed for the poor, but all anyone remembers him for is his root vegetable incident. Some even claim he was, how shall I say it, a bit naughty with a turnip, which is why it wasn't discussed further, which makes that quite gross. To me, it sounds like an attempt to besmirch his legacy, but unfortunately, that is all we have to go on. A man, his hunt, the field, and the so-called organic killer. The rest is sordid history. Eating your greens will keep you regular and healthy, but literally shoving them up your backside will... oh, forget it. Sports holds some of the most impressive records humanity has ever seen, and you have some incredible athletes, whether it's hockey, baseball, football, or even curling, which is a sport only Canadians care about. Then you have the other sports that are seen more as recreational, such as race car driving and, yes, horse racing. You no doubt have heard of the Indy 500 for motorsports and the Kentucky Derby for horse racers, but neither of those yearly events hold a candle to what this next man achieved. Let's marvel at the jockey known as Frank Hayes. Born in 1901 Ireland, there are many pieces missing about his early life. Unfortunately, I could not find more information. Some claim he was born in 1888 in Brooklyn, New York, so either could be true. He lived with his mother and sister, and as far as his father was concerned, he left early on. As Frank grew up, he was rarely home, instead spending time around horses, learning how to take care of them, and having a dream of being a jockey. His first step into that world was when he became a stable hand for a horse breeder called James Frayling, who saw Frank Hayes as a potential trainer. Hayes spent his days schooling horses, most of which became race winners, but his passion was in the saddle, then on the sidelines, and he was determined to do so. He was the mastermind behind the victories, however, when a winning horse came back into the winning enclosure, he very quietly washed down the horse and led them back to the stable, whilst the jockey took all the credit. His big break came when Miss Frayling had a horse called Sweet Kiss, and in June 1923, she wanted to see her horse out on the track. However, she was struggling to find a jockey at such short notice. Hayes offered to ride for her, but she declined, telling him his weight would hamper his chances of finishing in the top five. However, Hayes persisted, and eventually, after a lot of persuasion, she agreed to let him ride. According to the Buffalo Morning Express, he embarked on a grueling weight loss routine that involved hours of intense exercise and minimal food intake, but with only 24 hours before the race, he was still 10 pounds over the limit. He pushed himself even harder, denying himself water and sweating like crazy to make the weight. He succeeded, but as he climbed in the saddle for the race, he was visibly weak and tired. Nevertheless, at 35 years old, he was finally going to achieve his dream. The other jockeys in the locker room were overheard saying, without knowing, that they would be making history. The race started as expected with the favorite gimme, leading from very early on. Hayes and his horse Sweet Kiss surprised everyone by taking the lead on the final bend. The 7-year-old mare crossed the line just ahead in front, and the crowd roared as a 20-1 shot beat the pundit's favorite gimme. Oddly though, as they passed the winning post, Hayes was slumped forward on the horse, and at the time, many thought he was emotionally whispering in the mare's ear, not knowing what had actually occurred, as they were both led to the winner's circle. Frank still laid motionless in the saddle. An official had shaken him thinking he was passed out, but fell out falling face first into the dirt. Medical personnel quickly went to his aid, checking his vitals, but unfortunately, the race doctor soon pronounced him dead. Apparently at some point during the race, he suffered a heart attack and slumped against Sweet Kiss, but never fell off. Experts had observed that Sweet Kiss swerved slightly while approaching the final jump, which was later attributed to the jockey slumping forward too much. It was a bizarre win, but because the jockey stayed on the horse until they crossed the finish line, the result was valid. The aftermath was, as you may guess, rife with speculation as to when he died, what was to happen to the horse, and other wild theories. To this day, it isn't known just when he died, and as for the horse, the poor thing was given the new name, the Sweet Kiss of Death, due to him essentially killing his jockey to be a winner, and it never raced again. A week later, Frank was buried in his siding silks that got him his first and last win, earning him a spot in the Guinness Book of World Records as the only rider to finish in first place while dead. A morbid honor, to be sure, but a hard, if not impossible, record to break. What a way to go, indeed. Slow and steady wins the race. That is true. but life's race will push you to the finish line quicker if you allow yourself to do so, and that may be a race you don't want to win too quickly. Finally, I'm throwing you all a bit of a cosmic curveball in that this last entry will not be of a person, but of a beloved animal. An elephant, to be exact. Yes, it isn't just people that experience messed up crazy deaths, I know. So let's get to the very sad story of Topsy the elephant. Topsy was born in the wild around 1875 in Southeast Asia and was captured soon after by elephant traders and was given the name from the book Uncle Tom's Cabin, in which character was a slave girl, which seemed fitting given the circumstances. Adam Forepaw, owner of the Forepaw Circus, had the elephant secretly smuggled into the United States with plans that he would advertise the baby as the first elephant born in the United States. At the time, his circus was in competition with Barnum and Bailey over who had the most and largest elephants. Forepaw announced to the press in February 1877 that his circus now boasted the only baby elephant ever born on American soil. The elephant trader who sold Topsy to Forepaw also sold elephants to P.T. Barnum and tipped Barnum off about the deception, and Barnum took this opportunity to expose the hoax publicly, which led to Forepaw stopping the claim that Topsy was born in the United States, only advertising that she was the first elephant born outside a tropical zone instead. Over the years, Topsy gained a reputation as a bad elephant. In 1902, she killed a spectator named James Fielding Blount in Brooklyn, New York, at what was then the Forepaw and Sells Brothers Circus. Accounts vary as to what happened, but the common story is that on the morning of May 27, 1902, a possibly drunk Blount wandered into the menagerie tent, where all the elephants were tied in a line and began teasing them in turn, offering them a bottle of whiskey. He reportedly threw sand in Topsy's face and then burnt the extremely sensitive tip of her trunk with a lit cigar. Topsy threw Blount to the ground with her trunk and then crushed him with either her head, knees, or foot, or some combination thereof. Good job, Topsy. Newspaper reports on Blount's death contain what seem to be exaggerated accounts of Topsy's man-killing past, with claims that she killed up to 12 men, but with more common accounts during the 1900 season that she killed two Forepaw and Sells Brothers circus workers. However, journalist Michael Daly, in his 2013 book on Topsy, could find no record of anyone being killed by an elephant in Waco. A handler named Mortimer Laudet of Albany, New York, was attacked by Topsy in Paris, Texas, and suffered injuries, but Daly could not find a record of his dying from Topsy. The publicity generated by Topsy's actions brought very large crowds to the circus to see the elephant, if for nothing else, did you get a glimpse of the violent pachyderm. In June 1902, during the unloading of Topsy from a train in Kingston, New York, a spectator named Louis Dondero used a stick in his hand to tickle Topsy behind the ear. Topsy seized Dondero around the waist with her trunk, hoisted him high in the air, and threw him back down before being stomped by a handler. Due to this last incident, the owners of Forepaw and Sell Circus decided to sell Topsy since they could ill afford any more incidents. She was sold to Luna Park, formerly Sea Lion Park, and was put through more trauma. During the moving of the Luna animals in October 1902, handler William Ault was involved in an incident where he stabbed Topsy with a pitchfork, trying to get her to pull the amusement ride. When confronted by a police officer, Ault turned Topsy loose from her work harness to run free in the streets, leading to Ault's arrest. The occurrence was attributed to the handler's drinking, but it didn't stop with him there. In December 1902, a drunk Ault rode Topsy down the town streets of Coney Island and walked and tried to ride Topsy into the local police station. Accounts say Topsy tried to batter her way through the station door, and she set up a terrific trumpeting, leading the officers to take refuge in the cells. The handler was fired after the incident, but in my opinion, he should have been locked up. Sadly, this story does not have even one inkling of a happy ending, so brace yourselves. In 1903, Topsy was basically sentenced to death and to be used as a spectacle for Thomas Edison to demonstrate electricity by means of electrocution. No one would buy her, train her, or care for her. Years of abuse by cruel people deemed her a lost cause. Originally, they had planned on hanging her, but officials deemed it too cruel, but were not above selling tickets for 25 cents for people to watch. The owner of Luna was asked to help lead Topsy over the bridge to the platform in which she would be electrocuted, since she wouldn't budge, but he refused and said he wouldn't even do it for $1,000. Instead, they attached copper wires to her ankles, and Chief Electrician Sharky made sure everyone was clear. Then Topsy was fed carrots laced with 460 grams of potassium cyanide by press agent Charles Murray, who then backed away. At 2:45 p.m., Sharky gave a signal, and an electrician on a telephone told the superintendent at Coney Island Station, 9 blocks away, to close a switch, and Luna Park Chief Electrician Hugh Thomas closed another one at the park, sending 6,600 volts from Bay Ridge across Topsy's body for 10 seconds, toppling her to the ground. According to at least one contemporary account, she died without a trumpet or a groan. After Topsy fell, the steam-powered winch tightened two nooses placed around her neck for 10 minutes. At 2:47, Topsy was pronounced dead, ending her suffering. After the sick spectacle, it was said that Edison killed Topsy, but this turned out to be false, as the current wars had long ended when Tesla was defeated in favor of Edison. The thing is, before this, he had killed dogs, calves, and even horses to prove his superiority, so before you think he was innocent in all this, I can assure you that Edison was still a scumbag. Even though Topsy was gone, she kind of got the last laugh because, in a very glorious twist of fate, the circus that had housed her mysteriously burnt down shortly after, with people calling it Topsy's Revenge, which would make a really awesome name for a corkscrew-type roller coaster. On a more serious note, though, rest in peace, Topsy. Cruelty knows no bounds. An elephant never forgets, and it should be said that animals can feel just like you, albeit in different ways. Keep in mind, however, that if you let your guard down and they remember how you mistreated them, expect swift retribution, mauling, disfigurement, and quite possibly end up as an entry in one of my programs. And so at last we come to the end of our journey off of the mortal coil. Thank you so much for supporting this program. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed narrating. Be sure to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Also, be sure to follow me for news about the podcast on Instagram and Threads at the Nightcap Nebula Pod. I also have merchandise on TeePublic under the Nightcap Nebula Podcast, such as t-shirts and mugs for when you want to pour out some hot cocoa and get cozy by the fire as you listen to my segments. Until next time, be safe and stay curious.